Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colin Quinn. This week, we return to the topic of Syria and hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tom Friedman, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, and the Daily Beast senior national security correspondent Nancy Youssef. They were all in conversation with CSIS trustee and living legend Bob Schieffer this week at CSIS.
Let's say, put aside your journalistic hats right now, put on your expert hats, because you really are. If you all were advising the President of the United States right now, he's just ordered 50 special operations people into Syria. That's kind of the latest news, I guess. What would each of you advise the President at this moment? What would be your priorities? What would you tell him his strategy ought to be? What would you suggest? Where do we go from here? Tom, you want to?
I resign.
You resign.
I am flummoxed by Syria, so I've been very humble about how to approach it. So I and David knows a lot more about it than I do, because he's, I know, been really reporting, and I depend on his reporting for what's going on. So I would step back, Bob, and I would first ask the question, what's going on from 30,000 feet? And I mean historically from 30,000 feet. And in my view is that the Arab Muslim world is a pluralistic region that lacked pluralism. That is the core and, to me, central truth. And therefore, it had to be governed, with the rare exception of a country near and dear to me, Lebanon, it had to be governed vertically by iron fists from the top down. To manage pluralistic region, Sunni, Shiites, Kurds, Jews, Turks, Christians, Yazidis, who really had no pluralism. So for 500 years, that iron fist was called the Ottomans. For 50 years, it was called the British and French. And for 50 years, it was, the last 50 years, called kings, colonels, and dictators. And I think from 30,000 feet, what's going on, helped in part by us, but also driven very much from the bottom up as well in other countries, is there's no more Ottomans, there's no more British and French, and there are fewer kings, colonels, and dictators who can govern this region vertically with an iron fist from the top down. Therefore, it can actually only be governed horizontally by the constituent communities forging social contracts for how to live together as equal citizens. So what you're seeing, I think, from 30,000 feet is a region trying to go from a vertical system of political control to horizontal. Now, you can do that if you have one of three transition mechanisms, it seems to me. One is if you have a Mandela who can bring the parties together. It turns out there was only one of those, and he did not work the Arab world. Okay. Second is if you have a military, a far-sighted military. We hoped Egypt's military would play that role. Turned out they were more interested in their officers' clubs and their network of hotels and protecting that. Lastly is if you have a far-sighted midwife. That was the role we assigned ourselves to in Iraq and Afghanistan. Turned out we didn't know what we were doing. If you have no military, no Mandela, and no midwife, and you need to go from vertical control to horizontal control, you have the mess you have today. You have a region in can't be governed by iron fist anymore, but can't forge the pluralism that is required for horizontal, you know, governance. So you get ISIS. You get total fragmentation. And that's sort of one set of problems. The second set of problems, and the point I'm trying to make, is this is not your grandfather's political problem. This is a deep civilizational problem. You know, 60 years ago, I'm just making this up, but Asian leaders basically came to their people and said, my people, here's the deal. We're going to take away your freedom. But we're going to give you the best education, infrastructure, and export-led economics that money can buy. 60 years, you'll build a middle class big enough, you'll basically take your freedom back. And that's what happened in Indonesia, Taiwan, Korea, etc. In the Arab world, the Arab leaders came to their people 60 years ago and said, my people, here's the deal. We're going to take away your freedom, and we're going to give you the Arab-Israeli conflict. We're going to give you a shiny object over here to distract you from our predation. So what you see today is the sum total of that fork 60 years later. Back in 1950, South Korea and Egypt had the same per capita income. Today, I believe South Korea has a GDP triple the entire Arab world combined. So we are dealing with a deep, deep hole of incredibly bad choices made over multiple generations of misgovernance. So I am frankly humbled by the problem. I'm open, I would tell the president, to any rational solution anyone comes up to. I'm not against a no-fly zone, this or that. Just show me how it will work, how it will put this region on a different pathway, and as the national security advisor, I will sign on to it, and we can forge ahead.
David?
Well, I admire, that's Tom's elegant 30,000-foot view is is surely right. The problem for the president, the problem for me sitting up here, is that I want to respond to the immediate nightmare question of what should, okay, so what should we do right now? It is poignant, painful to watch this president who campaigned in 2008, who came into office with the idea that the mistakes the United States had made in the aftermath of 9/11, in particular with the invasion of Iraq, could be remedied over time by a gradual pullback towards, we speak of offshore balancing as the foreign policy concept. And it's clear that President Obama, with the support of the country, wanted to step back from these conflicts, reduce our military involvement. It was a passion. He was often attacked on Capitol Hill for being weak, feckless, but I think he was reflecting a deep, genuine feeling in the country. We've gone down the wrong road. We're stuck in this nightmare. As Tom says, these epical problems are playing out, and we're caught in the middle of them. To watch over the last several years that as we have stepped back, and we did step back, others have stepped forward in ways that severely complicate the nightmare in that part of the world. I mean, all the things Tom says are true, but I don't think that ISIS is inevitable, and I think left to itself, ISIS really does just get worse and worse. It metastasizes. So we have watched the president in the last few weeks, first with Afghanistan and now with Syria, pretty much the opposite of what he said he was going to do. And he's reacting, I think, correctly and appropriately to the reality of these nightmare problems played out against the tableau that Tom describes. I think his several of his basic ideas are correct. I think he is right to think that we do have a stake in degrading and ultimately, I won't say destroying, but containing ISIS. I think left to itself, it is dangerous to our friends, to Europe through terrorism, to our interests. And so I think we have a reason to be involved. I think he's also right in saying that we cannot do this ourselves. That's the abiding lesson of this period, is that unless people in the region take ownership of solving the problems, they don't get solved. I mean, we have watched the limits of our military power. We have an incredible military. Some of its very best people will be entering Syria from our special operations forces. But we've seen the limits of what they can do. So the president says, you must be involved. And I think finally, the president is correct in saying that responding to this over time, and I think Tom and I and Nancy would agree, this is through the rest of our lifetimes, through the rest of most of our lifetimes, this story will play out. I'd be surprised if we had much more than stable ceasefire lines anytime soon as a goal. So over this period in which we deal with this metastasizing problem, we need to have partners, we need friends, our power will be augmented, amplified to the extent that we're working with countries, people who share our interests. I am not someone who thinks that the clash of civilizations, Muslim versus Christian, Muslim versus whatever, is inevitable, inescapable. I just don't believe that. As I travel the Arab world, which I still try to do, I see an Arab world in vertigo and free fall. People just don't, they don't know where they are in space, and they need their friends, and I would say, first of all, America. I mean, look at how they reacted to Vladimir Putin just because he came in acting like he knew what he was doing. I don't think he really did. I don't think this is a tactician, not a strategist. But it was galvanizing for people who are in free fall. So I should turn it over to Nancy.
Well, Nancy, you grew up, your parents are Egyptian, mm-hmm. right? And you spent a lot of growing up time there and then here. So from your point of view and all the time you spent out there, where do we go from here?
Well, it's funny. I let me apologize for my voice. I can survive war, but not a cold, apparently, so I apologize. It's interesting. I was just thinking about David's comments. One of the things I hear so often is that Russia has a plan, but not a strategy, and the U.S. has a strategy, but not a plan. And so to your original question, what are some things that can be done? I think practically one thing that could be done is reconciling the language with which we talk about this war. Because the language actually affects the military fighting. Obama has presented himself as sort of a limited interventionist. We've sort of seen this trickling of U.S. troops in Iraq and now Syria. And yet we've said the goal is to defeat and degrade ISIS. If you're not willing to call it combat and what you're asking of the troops, how can you then hope to then defeat and degrade ISIS? That, in my mind, there has to be some reconciliation of the language. If it is containment, and that's fine, that the war fighting meet the goal, because I think one of the problems that Americans are having is we say we're committed to defeating and degrading ISIS, and yet we are reticent to put any sort of ground forces behind it. Just today, in the last 24 hours, in an interview with NBC News, Obama said, we're not going to be at the front lines. How do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile saying you're going to defeat ISIS and you don't want to be on the front lines? And so, as someone who's been watching this and seeing it from the Pentagon, I think that's one area. And the other area that you're starting to see change is, remember last year everybody was talking about we're going to go after Iraq first, the ISIS problem in Iraq, and then Syria. And we're starting to see an acknowledgement that those borders don't exist the way they did just a few years ago. You saw Secretary Carter's comments about his strategy, the three R's, Ramadi, Raqqa, and raids. And what that was an acknowledgement of is that this border does not exist, that to affect events in Syria, you have to do things in Iraq and vice versa. So in that sense, I think it's a movement forward. But overall, I think there are so many basics that have to be reconciled, because this has been something that the U.S. has been reticent to get involved in, but now it is involved, and that those questions need to be answered. As someone of the region, as someone who spent so much time on the front lines, I'm not as confident that U.S. intervention can fundamentally change this course of the region, that this has to be organic to the region. And so in that regard, these goals of defeating ISIS, I'm not sure that that's something the U.S. can do. The U.S. can help towards containing ISIS, but there are structural problems within the region that allow ISIS to grow. Even if you remove ISIS, for example, in Raqqa, if those structural problems aren't addressed, they just emerge somewhere else. And I think that's something for the region to address. And right now, there's not as much enthusiasm as one would like for that, because there are their own domestic factors at play. Someone like Sisi, for example, in Egypt, exploits ISIS to justify his return to dictatorial rule. And so those are some of the competing dynamics. But I would really stress the messaging be consistent with how U.S. troops are being deployed.
Well, how about this whole idea of we sent 50 special operations people out there? Can that make a difference? Is it going to take more?
Well, you know, I always go back to the Iraq experience, because in many ways, Bob, Iraq and Syria were twins. And one had a Sunni minority ruling a Shia majority. The one had, in effect, a Shia minority Alawite ruling a Sunni majority, and with a Kurdish element in both. And you know what happened as a result of the Iraq War is it kind of became against the law to talk about Iraq in this country. If you were for the war, as I was for democracy reasons, you should shut up and die. And if you were against it, you were a genius. But the thing itself never got discussed. So we spent $1 trillion. We lost 5,000 almost lives, Iraqis tens of thousands. There was never a Pentagon Papers. We never did what happened here, you know. And I think that's very important before you dive into Syria. You know, so I would give you my 1 minute analysis of the Iraq war. You know, and to me, Iraq was a grenade and Saddam was the pin. And we came in and pulled the pin and then did the geopolitical equivalent of falling on a grenade. We took the whole blast, we and our allies. But we did monopolize force in the country. We took over the country. Then we triggered a civil war. Didn't mean to, but didn't know what the hell we were doing. So we unleashed a civil war where the different communities tested one another. What you got, baby? What you got? That took about 3 years, and they exhausted themselves in the process. Then I would say we did the most radical thing America has done in the Arab world in the post-war period. We actually sponsored the first consensual election between the constituent communities and elements of an Arab country. But I think it's very important to understand. We did that from 8 in the morning until midnight. From midnight to 8 in the morning, General McChrystal and the boys took out a lot of bad actors on both sides. They basically took out the worst jihadis in both the Sunni and Shiite community. That allowed the center to be much more relaxed and come together. We had the 2010 election in which the most multi-sectarian party, the candidate running on the most multi-sectarian list, Iyad Alawi, got the most votes. We, in our brilliance, and people need to remember this when they say, let's dive into Syria. We then said, no, we're going to give it to Maliki. We know who's best to run this country. Of course, the Iranians wanted that too. And then we left. Okay. So when I look at Syria, if I were really proposing what I thought would work, it would be an international force. I think it has to take over the entire country. Decapitate the leadership, and govern the country for 5 years, and then maybe have an election 5 years later when you have calmed down the place, when you have created an economy, when you've stabilized Syria. I think anything less than that is a fool's errand. It's just not going to work, okay? And I think you have to study what happened in Iraq, both what we got right and what we got terribly wrong. I think there is Iraqis, when they had the security and the peace, what option did they choose? They chose multi-sectarian party. They did not want to live as Shiites and Sunnis and minorities. And I think it's something we really seriously miss. So if somebody wants to go all the way and get an international force, takes over the country, I will let you vote for that. But anything less than that strikes me as it's just not going to be effective.
It's hard to believe that 50 could actually have an impact, but from what I can tell, when you talk to people in the Pentagon, the idea is to use those 50 to help cut off supply lines that ISIS gets. The Kurds just took over Talabiya, which is a border town in northern Syria. They have a very tenuous hold on it, but one of the key advantages of Talabiya is that it cuts off an ISIS supply line from Turkey into Syria to Raqqa. It seems that these 50 are designed to get the Kurds and the Arabs to work together, very optimistic, and go after some of the supply lines. It's why you're starting to hear the Kurds going after Sinjar in Iraq to start to cut off that supply line from Iraq into Syria. Now that Talabiya is in Kurdish control, that appears to be the goal, with the ultimate goal to then go after Raqqa. The complication is the Kurds, their goal is a contiguous state. And they'll Raqqa's not really part of their equation. They'll do it, but they will tell you they cannot hold it, and so there's a limit to what those advisors can do. There's great enthusiasm for going after Raqqa, but it's interesting. We're starting to see. Remember last year, everybody's talking about Mosul, and we started to hear Raqqa. That you're starting to see people sort of step back a little bit and start to think strategically about how to make a Raqqa battle to your greatest advantage. It is ambitious at best. Sinjar will be a difficult battle, as enthusiastic as the Kurds are about it. And so 50 advisors in and of itself doesn't seem very impactful, but potentially they cut off supply lines. And then the real question becomes, even if they're successful in cutting off those supply lines, will ISIS find another route to get supplies in? Is it a game of whack-a-mole, or is it something that really leads to an enduring impact on the quality of life for ISIS and Raqqa?
David, you wrote recently, we simply have to improve our intelligence capabilities. Putin's arrival in Syria was just the latest in a very long list of surprises, the rise of ISIS also. totally surprising. Is better intelligence actually possible?
Well, that's the right question. I am convinced as I look at each of these stories, Iraq, now Syria, the larger Arab Spring, that the abiding truth with each is that we just don't know enough. We're making consequential decisions that lead to multi-trillion dollar engagements. Our country has been really reshaped by the Iraq War, and we didn't know enough. These are extremely hard targets to penetrate and collect intelligence about. Our ability to use electronic systems has been our salvation, not just in this conflict, but really through the Cold War as well. Our technical collection has always been superb and makes up for a lot of other shortcomings. But I'm certain that before making more big decisions, we need to know more. One reason I think it's wise of the president to send this very limited force on the ground into Syria is so that we will know more. We'll have a little bit more of that ground truth, that granularity at our fingertips. We authorized and spent $500 million to build a Syrian opposition force that basically, Lloyd Austin said they had five or six, they had more than five or six, but the few people they had just walked into a trap when they were deployed in July in northern Syria because of poor intelligence. They literally walked into a trap. Some were kidnapped, they were then attacked by people we thought would not. So we do need absolutely to know more. Say one more thing about this force of 50 people. This force and the group that it's supporting is an example of one of the few bits of good fortune that we've had in this conflict, which is that these Syrian Kurds in the group that's known as the YPG, which is the Kurdish initials for People's Protection Unit, are fierce, committed fighters. And they've been incredibly successful on the battlefield. By the count of the people who work with them at the Pentagon, they have taken 17,000 square kilometers in northeast Syria. They have just rolled. They have rolled west along the Turkish border all the way to the Euphrates, and then they had to be stopped because the Turks were so upset. They devastated ISIS in Kobani. There were 3,000 to 4,000 killed. I mean, they are tough fighters. We have been supporting them from the air. Our ability to, you know, from the air, lays targets and then go in pretty closely is now, quite extraordinary. But what the president basically decided was these fighters who stood up and have done well, we're going to support more. Not a whole lot more, but we're going to support them with 50 people on the ground. And those people will enable more aggressive operations. I think Nancy's right about cutting off routes, but I've written that the idea is sometime in the spring, over the next hill, we will move toward Raqqa. There was a battle yesterday in a town to the east of Raqqa as we begin to help them close in. So I think, again, going back to what I said at the beginning, the only way to think about this is to help people who will stand up for themselves. These people are fighting for their lives and where they live and fighting for their future. They're brave as hell. And I think the president probably is right to do it, not 100%, thousands of people, but these 50 will make a difference.
Bob, just to pick up on something David said, this is the Schieffer School event. David and I have, I think I can say this, covered every Middle East war since 1975 on the ground, either as correspondents there or as columnists or whatnot. This is the first war we can't cover. I mean, I've been to Tel Abyad for a day. But it wasn't like living in Beirut, going from the Falangists to the Palestinians to the Marabitun. So by the end of the day, we, the reporters, had an incredibly rounded view of what was going on. And as a collective group, not any one individual, but as a collective, we were a source of enormous intelligence for the reading public, but also for the government. This is the first war I can't cover. You get your head chopped off. So there's no one, and yeah, the Arab news organizations will send someone in for a day here. There's nothing living there. Hearing the asides from people, understanding the true texture and rhythm, what's going on, what's driving an ISIS, you know. To me, it's related to a second point. To me, the single greatest underappreciated factor of Arab politics, as we write about it, because we tend to write about it in these grand ideological terms, is governance. Okay, and mostly misgovernance, corruption, injustice. That's what the Arab Spring was about. How people live their lives every day. And it's true, we can find, you know, Kurds who will fight with us or whatever against this group or that. But ultimately, these are Sunni regions. And without good Sunnis to replace bad Sunnis, Sunnis who are ready to rule and in a just way their own populations, it's not going to work. Okay, I mean, at the end of the day, the Middle East only puts a smile on your face when it starts with them. Okay, when it starts with them, it has the single most important quality of any issue in international relations. It is self-sustaining. And without self-sustaining, decent governance, there is no town we can't take. There's no government we can't topple. But without local people ready to rule and govern in a decent and just way, nothing is sustainable. That's the lesson of Afghanistan. It's the lesson of Iraq.
It was a lesson of Vietnam.
Yeah, it's about governance. Which was, and we so rarely talk about that. Because we find our bastards to rule instead of their bastards. But they're bastards at the end. And the people know that. And that's what it's about.
Let's shift to the latest surprise. One day, Putin shows up. Russians start moving in. Does Putin think that he can actually impose a military solution on all of this?
He doesn't have to. I mean, he won so much by being able to come in and win the Arab street in the matter of a day by doing these very indiscriminate strikes aggressively. You had Iraqis asking for Russian intervention after what they saw in Syria. So he doesn't have to have a big military win, and that's the view from the Pentagon, the fact that he's been able to impact the war puts him back on the world stage, and arguably that was the goal. And at the same time, the visit that Assad did to Moscow a few weeks later gave Assad some legitimacy, and so he was able to protect Russian interests. Remember that the Russians have both a naval base and an airfield in Syria and have had long-standing relationships with them. And so he doesn't have to have a major tactical win, although that would be great. He's gained a lot just by being able to come in and completely reshape how we talk about Syria and who are the people who have to be at the table when it comes time for reaching a political settlement.
And that was Nancy Youssef bringing us to the end of this week's show. If you'd like more from CSIS, catch this week's Cogitasia podcast, which features U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes on this week's elections in Myanmar. It's another one not to be missed. Until next week, I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.